Judas, Part 2. Another slice of Celtic history on the Celtic Wiki. The departure of Maurice Johnston to Nantes in the summer of 1987 was an undoubted blow to the hopes of the Celtic fans. However, manager Billy McNeil moved quickly to rebuild his team, and Super Mo was quickly replaced as the darling of the terraces by West Ham's Frank McAvennie. McAvennie was another striker with an eye for the women and a love of the high life. Like Johnston, he'd quit a successful career in England to play for his boyhood idols at Celtic Park. In his first season, Frank helped Celtic to a League and Cup double in the club's centenary year, but the next term saw McAvennie get itchy feet for London. And citing similar concerns to Johnston some 18 months earlier, he quit Glasgow and returned to the Hammers in early 1989. Rangers were on the verge of regaining the league championship, and were a Derby Scottish Cup final triumph away from trumping Celtic's double of the previous season with a treble. With McAvennie now back in London, the Hoops were in desperate need of a lift. Despite being a success on the pitch, Johnston had not really settled in France, and while on international duty, he had made it known to ex-Celtic teammate Roy Aitken that he would welcome a return to Parkhead. Aitken passed this information on to Billy McNeil, and the wheels were put in motion to bring Johnston back to Glasgow. McNeil spoke to the player and made it clear he was in no mood to be messed around. He informed Johnston he would deal with him, but didn't want anything to do with his agent, Bill McMurdo. McMurdo was renowned as a staunch Rangers fan, whose loathing of Celtic probably surpassed his love of the Ibrox club. Johnston agreed to McNeil's request, and soon signed a letter agreeing to join Celtic on July 1st, 1989, in a club record £1.2 million deal. Celtic chairman Jack McGinn and director Chris White flew to France to pay Nantes a £400,000 deposit on the deal. The club then checked with officials at FIFA to ensure that all the paperwork was correct and legally binding. FIFA assured Celtic that everything was in order. Although Johnston had not signed a contract, his letter of intent was akin to a pre-contract agreement signed by players today. This being the case, and with just 8 days to go before the cup final, Celtic decided to announce the deal to the public, and Johnston was paraded before the media, back in the Hoops, as a Celtic player. When asked why he had come back to Celtic, the striker declared, "I don't want to play anywhere else." Johnston then travelled with the team to Love Street for their final league game of the season, and throughout the game, the visiting support sang Johnston's name as they welcomed home their hero. Or so they thought. The following week, at sunny Hampden, a Joe Miller strike gave Celtic the cup and denied Rangers the treble. After a disappointing season, the joyous Hoop support were now revelling in an unexpected feel-good factor. As thousands of celebrating Celtic fans streamed out of Hampden, street sellers were doing a roaring trade in Mo Johnston t-shirts, scarves, hats and flags. It seemed that the good times were on their way back. What Johnston had failed to mention at the press conference was that he had with him correspondence from Bill McMurdo informing Celtic that his company and not Nantes owned Johnston's contract. McMurdo's letter made it clear that unless Celtic spoke to him, the no deal would be completed. The club first picked up on the problem the Monday after the cup final, when Johnston failed to turn up for a meeting. It then quickly became obvious that McMurdo was now starting to pull Johnston's strings. While Celtic tried to track down Johnston and attempt to resolve their outstanding issues, McMurdo was enjoying lunch with Graham Souness. The Rangers manager was an admirer of Johnston, and he quizzed his friend as to why he had let the striker rejoin Celtic. McMurdo made it clear that the move to Parkhead was far from done and dusted, and that given a little persuasion, Johnston could be well tempted south of the Clyde. Souness did not need to be asked twice. He was astute enough to know that stealing a former Parkhead hero from under the noses of a desperate Celtic would be a bitter blow to his rivals. Should he strengthen his own club in the process, then all the better. Ibrox chairman David Murray needed no persuasion to agree to the move. Murray, a man with a near unrivalled ego, couldn't resist any opportunity which would create the hysterical levels of press coverage that this move would generate. The one stumbling block to the move would be the reaction of the Rangers support, who viewed the club's disgraceful sectarian signing policy as integral to their warped sense of identity. The public signing of a Catholic would be bad enough, but to sign a Catholic who was an ex-Celtic player and who once blessed himself after being sent off in a derby game would seem unthinkable. But Murray and Souness knew that in terms of a bigger picture, the club's sectarian signing policy was a hindrance, and that if they seriously wanted to challenge the best on the continent, then this particular facet of their deplorable tradition had to be dumped. And what better way to do it than by striking a major blow against your fiercest rivals. At McMurdo's recommendation, Johnston agreed to meet Souness at the Rangers manager's Edinburgh home. Unable to resist the persuasive nature of Souness and his agent, Johnston agreed to a move to Ibrox. By now, Celtic and the player had publicly acknowledged there was a problem with the deal, but outwardly, both at least expressed the expectation that these matters would soon be ironed out. Behind the scenes at Parkhead, though, concern was growing with every passing minute. Celtic had confirmed once more with FIFA that the agreement signed by the player was legally binding. Safe from the knowledge that it was, Billy McNeil satisfied himself there was no need to be concerned about the rumours sweeping Glasgow that Rangers had made a move for Johnston. At the very least, he thought, Celtic could pay the remaining £800,000 in advance for Johnston's registration. Even if the player didn't agree to play, they would at least control his football destiny and prevent Rangers from completing a sensational signing coup. However, the Celtic board had other ideas, and despite having Johnston's signature on a legally binding agreement, they announced, while McNeil was still on holiday in Florida, that they were withdrawing from the deal. That short-sighted decision left the door wide open for Murray and Souness to close the deal on the most controversial signing in Scottish football history. After weeks of whispers, Johnston was unveiled to the world as a Rangers player at Ibrox Park on July the 10th, 1989. The move met with a predicted reaction. Press and media coverage was frenzied. Media commentators fell over themselves to praise Rangers, and in particular Murray and Souness, for bringing to an end the club's bigoted signing policy. Ironically, it was a bigoted policy which until this point Rangers had virtually denied ever existed. It was also a policy which many of the hacks and pundits now praising its demise had failed to criticise once while in practice. Reaction from the Rangers support was one of anger. Season tickets were cancelled, scarves burned, and many supporters vowed never to return. They did, of course, as Rangers went from strength to strength and began a near decade-long dominance of the domestic game. But at the time, David Miller, General Secretary of the Rangers Supporters Association, told the Herald, "It's a sad day for Rangers. I don't want to see a Roman Catholic at Ibrox." Such bigotry was not confined to the stands, though, and some of Johnston's new teammates were less than happy at having to share a dressing room with a Catholic, even one as clearly lapsed in faith and morals as Johnston. His welcome at Ibrox was frosty, as both players and backroom staff initially kept their distance from their new colleague. The reaction from the Celtic support was ferocious. But unlike the Rangers support, this ill feeling was not born from bigotry, but out of a deep sense of betrayal. Here was a player who had enticed the club to take him back into its fold, but when Celtic needed him most, he jilted them for their most bitter rivals in the cruelest of fashions. In the eyes of Celtic supporters, his actions were beyond redemption. He'd committed the ultimate sin. And what made matters worse, he did so knowing exactly how much hurt he was causing his supposed fellow Celtic supporters and how much damage he was doing to the club. At the Ibrox press conference, He spoke of his excitement and great admiration for Rangers. His words were another kick in the teeth to the Celtic fans. In many ways, Johnston was used as a pawn by Murray, Souness and McMurdo, but he entered into the whole deal with his eyes wide open. Even given the fact that the player's greed and stupidity meant he was easily manipulated, it was ultimately Johnston's decision to sign on the dotted line. The reaction from both sets of the divide was fierce, but no more so than would have been predicted. Johnston wasn't that stupid to expect any other response. The Celtic support were not just angry at the player, but also at the board for their bumbling incompetence that they showed throughout the whole fiasco, and the manner in which they all but gifted Rangers the opportunity to complete their coup. Together, Johnston and the board had left the fans feeling let down and humiliated. The switch obviously meant that Johnston burnt his bridges with the Hoops fans for good. For the White Kelly axis, which ran the board, it was in many ways the beginning of the end, as they were to never again regain the confidence of the support. Johnston went on to enjoy a successful, if relatively brief, Rangers career, although he never quite hit the scintillating scoring form he showed during his spell at Parkhead. In an incident caught on camera, he did however show that he would stoop to any depth to try and ingratiate himself with his new paymasters as he joined his teammates in a sectarian sing-song. A winning goal against Celtic helped win over some of the Ibrox fans, but despite this goal and Johnston's sectarian sing-along, the player was never more than grudgingly accepted by support, but some 20 odd years later still remain entrenched in bigotry. In that respect, the signing of Johnston did more short-term damage to Celtic than long-term good to Rangers. After 31 goals in 76 appearances, Johnston would quit Ibrox and return to England in the summer of 1991 when he joined Everton. He stayed on Merseyside for two seasons before coming back to Scotland for brief spells with Hearts and Falkirk. After a successful stay in America's MSL with Kansas City Wizards, he retired from playing at the age of 38, but he would remain in North America as a coach. Johnston states that the most memorable day of his career was helping Celtic snatch the league title away from Hearts on the last day of the 1985-86 season at Love Street. He even claims he is still a Celtic fan. Unfortunately for the man now better known as Judas, his actions in July 1989 speak a lot louder than his subsequent words.